The Guardian.
Hi, I'm superstar DJ Trevor Nelson, and you're listening to The Guardian Football Weekly, or as I like to call it, News of My Microwave.
Hello, hope you had a nice summer, and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. After another title-winning season for the pod last year, the big question, can we get silverware again amidst the stiffest competition ever? The Game, The Ramble, Sunday Supplement, My Dad Wrote a Porno, all the TalkSport ones, Robbie Savage and his friends, Colin Murray in his house, that's all the ones we can think of. We have to ask ourselves, are there too many football podcasts? Has the football podcast bubble burst? When will football podcasts eat themselves? Until they do, we are here, and we're here to discuss the following. Neymar for £200 million. Has the Game gone again? Sid will tell us. We'll decide how interesting the transfer window has been so far. Look ahead to the Community Shield. England are just hours away from losing on penalties in a major tournament. We'll be live in Utrecht ahead of the Lionesses semi-final with Holland. And the Football League starts this week. John Ashdown will have a preview. And what is that elephant in the room? And did Stan Kroenke shoot it? And that is far too much content for today's Football Weekly. We have a panel. Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Hello.
We've got lots to do, but we've got to be out by one, haven't we?
Yes.
For why?
I'm being fitted for orthopaedic implants for my arthritic feet to prolong my cricket career for another 5 to 8 years.
Are you thinking maybe it's time to retire from the game? Or
from
not?
Cricket? I've literally never played better than I've played this summer. Okay. I've just cracked it. And that's a stupid thing to say, isn't it?
And your figures?
The thing with stats is they don't always reflect form in the short term.
Yeah, I think you're right. Greg Bukowski, how are you?
I'm good. I'm not being fitted for implants.
Okay, of any sort?
No, because I've not played football for a long time. But maybe I'll get some if they work out for you.
I did try and sign you about a minute ago, didn't I, for my team? But you did, turned me down.
Yeah, you play too far away.
Yeah, that's true. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Are you well prepared for today's pod?
Well, I've spent the summer, I've summered well.
Yeah.
Gorging myself on cycling and tennis and cricket. Haven't seen a huge amount of football, but, you know, we'll see how things go.
But you are here.
Yes, at least I'm here.
Hey, look, I bought a present.
Who are you, by the way? You haven't introduced yourself.
Hi, my name's Max, by the way. I bought a present.
Oh.
It's a new Dawn. The future Mrs. Rushton's done some baking, and I'm not trying to buy your support, but I've got mini banana muffins. She doesn't take criticism well. I've obviously learnt to take criticism well.
and I expect there will be plenty coming your way.
Which is probably a good thing.
So
maybe when near the end of the pod, we can all have a mini banana muffin.
When Sid starts, it'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. When we ask Sid a question, then we'll all tuck in. She did say to me, just be yourself, Max. Don't try and be funny. Okay, we have to start with this question, gentlemen. Why would someone at the most prestigious team in the world, loved by their fans, revered by their teammates, on big money, have their head turned by an inferior, less established outfit right before the start of the season? Barry.
That's a very good question.
Thanks.
Max.
Thanks, Barry.
Yeah, your open question. I'm guessing, well, you know, there's been illegal tap-ups, smiling assassins. It's a very tawdry business. You've got to presume it's all to do with money. You know, the amount of money sloshing around the game. I'm guessing that's what it was. I haven't really been kept in the loop, but I'm sure.
You don't think it might be that certain figures, you know, feel are overshadowed by maybe funnier, better
Irish,
more skillful
teammates? That hadn't actually occurred to me, but now that you mention it, maybe that's entirely what it is. They were intimidated by being in the shadow of that vastly superior teammate. Because it is the big story of the summer.
Absolutely, it is, isn't it? Mm. On another note, Neymar, sort of secondary issue, clearly, but PSG have met the £198 million buyout fee. Do you reckon anyone at Barcelona is wishing they'd just made it £400 million.
Yeah, I mean, when they set that fee, I don't think they ever thought it was possible anybody would match it. You know, I think they thought that was an academic figure. You pick a huge number, nobody will ever pay it. I mean, this is more than double the previous transfer record, which already seemed slightly insane. So, yeah, there's no way that Neymar, any player, can be worth £198 million plus, you know, pretty much the same again in wages on an intrinsic level. But PSG, I think they need to make a statement to say that they are a major player. And I think more than that, Qatar need to make a statement that obviously local political difficulties of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and there, you know, I think there has been a...
I knew I'd be out of my depth. I didn't realise it'd be this soon.
Well, you know, the various sanctions taken against Qatar. Qatar have notably over the last couple of months, A, been aligning themselves with Turkey and Iran more than they had been, but B, and more significantly here, they've been saying, yeah, we've had retrenchment because of the falling oil price. I mean, they've even been talking about having a tax regimen for the first time ever. There's been layoffs to do with the World Cup and the construction projects there. So, you know, the untrammeled supply of cash has to an extent been turned off. But over the last couple of months, they've clearly been saying, we're still incredibly rich. We're still the richest per capita nation in the world. And if you can break the world transfer record by a factor of two and get your team to buy that player, and it's not insignificant, I don't think, I'd be interested to see what Sid says about this, that Qatar Airways deal with Barcelona ended on June the 30th. This seems to me Qatari soft power, PSG the beneficiaries or not, depending how it works out. And Neymar, you know, a pawn in the game, but a pawn he's going to make an absolute fortune.
He's
going
to change his headband to "I belong to Qatar" instead of Jesus.
Well, I mean, it's a fact whether he does that or not. Yeah.
And the other thing is, in terms of financial fair play, like those rules were softened over the last few years to allow for teams like Leicester to spend to catch up with the rest. But in PSG's case, it seems that the outlay is so staggering that they will have to sell some of the other players in the team.
Well, bearing in mind that they were sanctioned in 2014. Mm.
And if they do that, then you're bringing Neymar in and you can't guarantee that you're going to be able to strengthen the team around him. It will be Neymar, unless his ego is so huge that he does see himself as a kind of Maradona figure going to Napoli. Even Napoli had a very good team at that time.
I heard Matt Scott, formerly of this parish and proper journalist.
We don't talk about people formerly of this parish, just so you know.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
A bloke I know was on the radio recently, and he was being asked, you know, how this works financial fair play wise. I think Sid's done an explainer in today's paper on the website, and will be on the blower shortly to explain. But this guy who knows what he's talking about, he did explain. It's very complicated, and I can't remember the grisly details, but there is a way to sort of bypass financial fair play, and it involves paying players through offshore accounts. It's totally legal, but and it can be done. So it kind of renders financial fair play
Well, I mean, presumably what you could do as well would be to have a Qatari club, also bankrolled by QSI, buying a PSG player for $150 million. Or, you know, $250 million, whatever.
To cover the
and redistribute
FFP
the wealth that
thing.
Way, yeah.
Like the City kind of setup they have with Melbourne and New York.
Yeah, but in a much more sort of cynical way.
Should we find out what Sid thinks?
I think we better.
Yeah, let's do that.
He is still with us.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to try. We'll call him and see if he's there. And if we don't have Sid, we'll get a kind of a Spanish expert banter merchant. And see if he'll cover for us.
I know David Ferreira.
You do. Sid Lowe, reporting on this story live from East Anglia. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Obviously, you will know what the reaction to this whole story has been in Spain. What's gone down?
Well, I must admit, I've been quite surprised today. I mean, you know, inevitably some bitterness was going to happen. But I've been quite surprised by, you see, for example, the front page of AS, which is pay and go. The front page of Sport is the equivalent of saying good riddance. And of course, we will now get the rewriting of this, where the rewriting will be, well, it was never that good anyway. And €220 million is loads of money. But I think the reality of how significant this could be for Barcelona is actually demonstrated by the last couple of weeks when they knew this was a possibility. They knew that he was thinking over his future. I suspect possibly had already made up his mind, but you know, they were kind of playing through the various rounds of the game of cards that they had to play first. And that rather than saying, okay, then play the buyout clause, off you go, we'll deal with this, we'll buy others, there was a battle to try and keep him. And the battle to try and keep him was fundamentally because I think deep down everybody knows that there probably isn't a player this good on the market. That yes, the fee is absolutely enormous, but of course, as soon as you get the fee, every other fee becomes enormous. And I think this almost certainly debilitates Barcelona. I think they would have to manage this extremely well for it not to. And of course, I would include myself in this. Most people don't trust Barcelona to manage €222 million particularly well.
What do you think they'll do with it?
Well, I mean, obviously, one of the things that I think they have to do personally, and this is, you know, an opinion rather than a fact, is actually resist that urge to go and do something quick, to go and do something dramatic to sort this out. And you know, you look back at the Figo case and the way they wasted all the money they got for Figo and basically created a crisis that needn't have happened. They've obviously they're interested in Coutinho, but Liverpool are not moving at all on that. They want a striker. Dembele is one of the key targets from Dortmund. The suggestion in the last few days of Antoine Griezmann, which next summer would be plausible, but right now his buyout clause is €200 million. So you basically lose all the money you had on Neymar for that. May not be a bad thing, but you've got to persuade him to go. Having backed away from a move that he thought was done, and you know, this whole discourse about how it wouldn't be fair on Atletico Madrid. So I must admit, I'm not sure where this goes. And as I say, there's a bit of me that thinks what they should do right now is do nothing, is not allow themselves to be kind of driven by that knee-jerk need to go and sort this out straight away.
So do you think this deal would have happened if Qatar Airways had still been Barcelona's shirt sponsor?
Yeah, I mean, I floated this idea yesterday, and it's no more than an idea, but there's a bit of me that does think that there's a kind of a tempting link there, isn't there? That not just that did Barcelona got rid of Qatar as their sponsorship, because that's one thing, and obviously that's significant in its own right. And had they still been the sponsorship, then maybe there would have been a desire not to rock the boat, not to make the relationship between Qatar and Barcelona difficult. But it's not just that. It's that they got rid of this first shirt sponsorship over a period of time in which everybody publicly said, well, we shouldn't really have Qatar, and isn't it a disgrace that it's Qatar? And the board, even while Qatar was still sponsoring them, were kind of implicitly saying, we all know this is wrong, and getting rid of them is something we've got to do. So it wasn't just, we're no longer with you, it's we've ditched you, we don't want to be with you. And there is a little bit of me that thinks, Qatar could have looked at that and thought, all right then, all right, we'll see how this plays, let's go and do it.
How much do you think is Neymar thinking about himself and wanting to win the Ballon d'Or? It seems strange to me why anyone would really care about that, but then I'm not particularly close to winning it.
Yeah, on the face of it, I think there is something horribly, horribly flawed about the idea of you're driven by winning this individual award, when it feels to me, at least, you should be driven by trying to win the World Cup. I think a lot of players, and I mean particular players' environments, players' entourage, do think like that, that, you know, this is about proving that this individual player is the best, and the way you do that is winning the Ballon d'Or. And I definitely think there is an element of that. Obviously, it would be naive to overlook the fundamental factor of the money. You know, it's the old Mrs. Merton joke, isn't it? You know, you know, what is it that attracts you to this millionaire club that can pay you double your salary, make you the most expensive player in the world, and, by the way, give your dad a cool €38 million at the same time, who's driving this? And I suspect that this actually fits a broader kind of long-term plan, which is you take Neymar to Barcelona, he wins something there, he's big there, he becomes a big name, then you go to Paris Saint-Germain, you do something there, and I suspect maybe then goes to another club after that as well. And it becomes about him rather than the clubs. From Barcelona's point of view, I suppose, you know, the miscalculation is that the idea was that Neymar was put into play with Messi and eventually take over from him. Bear in mind, he's 5 years younger. And I guess maybe Neymar was in more of a hurry than Barcelona were.
The line to East Anglia obviously is not as good as the line to Spain. Just one quick other note. La Keeper saying that Kylian Mbappe said he's decided to leave and well, among PSG and Man City, but as well Real Madrid, apparently interested. Would you see him going to Real?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this actually is a surprisingly important story. I mean, on the face of it, you say, he said he's decided to leave. You say, well, yeah, of course. But actually, one of the key points in this, the Mbappe story throughout the summer, has been that at no point had he said he wanted to leave. His preference, we were told, I mean, obviously, you know, the briefings, you can be briefed for all sorts of different reasons, not all of them simply the truth, was that actually he would rather hang on and develop for a year and have another year there. But of course, he's watching the rest of the Monaco players being sold off. He now wants to go, so that does change the market there. Real Madrid have pursued him. Real Madrid have spoken to him. Real Madrid have made promises about clearing his path for him as well. And of course, that has implications for one or two or perhaps all three of the front three of Bale, Benzema and Cristiano Ronaldo. And he is, you know, his preference, I think, would be Real Madrid. He is a Real Madrid fan, although obviously, ultimately, that doesn't always matter when it comes to making a decision. But I would imagine that Barcelona would look at him pretty seriously now because they have the money to buy him. It would prevent Real Madrid from doing so. And certainly at some levels, he's a semi-natural replacement for Neymar. Not exactly, but he's certainly a player that would fill a bit of that gap.
Atletico Madrid's new stadium, have the builders still working away frantically? Or
well, they've been protected a little bit. The first 2 weeks of the season, they will play away. So their first two games will be away. The draw brought them out home, but that was turned around and they play away. And they say it will be ready. I think it will be ready in so much as there'll be a dressing room, a football pitch and some seats for people to sit on. But I think quite a lot of the other things won't be done. And one thing's for sure, the access routes for cars and the transport and so on will almost certainly be an absolute shambles.
We've had a statement that says, this is breaking, we can confirm, this is BBC Sport, the lawyers of the player of Neymar have come to La Liga to deposit the clause, I'm assuming a big hold-all, and it's been rejected. That's all the information.
Yeah. Yep.
Is this what will happen, Sid, or is this a huge...
No, this won't change. Ultimately, I think it won't change how this plays out. It's part of a power game. It's the league trying to stand up to Paris Saint-Germain, trying to stand up to the French league, to the fear that Paris Saint-Germain's huge amounts of money can be a real challenge to Madrid and Barcelona, who, of course, are the kind of the standard bearers of the Spanish league. And ultimately, I think there will be many, many ways around this. But it's the league kind of going through that process in order to say, we're standing up for Barcelona, we're going to fight this. Ultimately, I don't think it will change anything, and I actually think it will probably be resolved relatively quickly.
And on the subject of big moves, have you been approached by big money? Has that turned your head at all, or are you happy to stay at the club that you supported as a boy?
Well, I'm currently checking my contract to see what the buyout clause is.
Okay.
I suspect it's not very high, so it's dangerous, isn't it?
Is that a come and get me plea from low? Cheers, Sid. We'll speak to you next week, hopefully.
Bye. Nice one. Speak to you then.
Cheers, Sid. That'll do for part one.
Just one thing's worth noting. I mean, people have been going on about how much money Neymar is going to earn, but anyone who's ever had a pint on the Champs-Élysées, you know, 500,000 euros a week doesn't go as far, perhaps, as it would in other cities.
I did actually have one question for you, Barry, which is, would you prefer one Neymar, four Sigurdssons or eight Arnautovic's?
I think I'd prefer four Sigurdssons.
Either of you?
I'd go for the Arnautovic's.
Really?
Be interesting.
A lot of
yeah, they'd all fall, lot. They'd fall out with each other. And it'd be such good fun.
Some games you would be amazing, and some would be absolutely useless. All right, that's it for part one. In part two, we'll do a bit of the transfer window in the Premier League, and we'll look at the Football League, which kicks off this weekend. Welcome back to part two of the first Guardian Football Weekly of the season. If you're still with us. Right, let's look at the transfer window in the Premier League. Barry, I know you hate the transfer window and you just wish there was no rumours and you didn't know anything and then you just turned up on the first game of the season and you'd seen who you'd got. But
yes,
that isn't
because
how
then I wouldn't know that Sunderland have got Lewis Graben and James Vaughan up front.
You'd also be out of a job, kind of.
Yeah, there are other things to write about.
To be fair, mate, did you actually know that before you emailed me yesterday or not?
I did, yes.
Barry on the phone to me yesterday was like, I've got so much work to do. I've got to write this thing about Sunderland. I asked Jonathan Wilson. He basically sent me an article that I'm going to cut and paste. Anyway, who do we think has had the best window so far, Jonathan? At the top of my list, it says Manchester United.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's not necessarily what I've put. I'm just a performing monkey here.
I don't know. I mean, City
monkeys are loyal.
So yes,
don't do yourself down.
Well, they're not though, are they? There's kind of constant battle to be the alpha male in the troop.
Okay.
Well, at least they don't go off and form their own troop, I suppose.
Sitting on a tyre,
drinking their own pee. I mean,
we knew, Barry, we had a meeting where we said we'd reference it, we wouldn't go too far. Anyway, it's fine. Keep it in, producer Jason.
What's in those muffins?
Right. Well, look,
I think there's two answers to that. In terms of players brought in, I think Greg, you're right. I think City, they've filled a lot of obvious deficiencies from last season, but it has cost an enormous amount of money. And the other answer is, who hasn't overpaid? Tottenham, because they've paid anything. So you then get to the question of, are we in a bubble? So I compared it in a piece to the tulip situation in the Netherlands in the early 17th century. Well, I actually think there's a better example. The tulip thing is these tulips got a blight, a mosaic blight. So they got marbled petals, which nobody had seen before. You had two colours on the same petal.
Did people react or badly to
this? They went mad for it. Okay. The price of tulips just kept going up and up and up. 1604 it begins.
Okay.
And for 35 years, you have the church and the guilds going, this is madness, this can't last, this can't last. And then suddenly one day, 1639, in Harlem, there's this tulip market, and nobody turns up. Now, there is some suggestion that it was because of an outbreak of plague, but the bottom falls out of the market and loads of tulip merchants are bankrupted. Okay. I actually think
only way the bubble in the Premier League will die is if the Black Death comes back.
That's certainly a way.
Okay.
Or Brexit, whichever's first.
Right.
I think the better example is the Indian horse market of the 17th century. 17th century was ripe for bubbles.
How do you know this stuff?
I play cricket with historians.
This what passes for pavilion banter?
This is high-grade banter where I come from.
So in the cordon, you're talking about the... I love this. Okay, so the horse what, sorry?
The Indian horse market of the 17th century. So
I did half my degree on Indian history.
Okay, so you probably know about
totally
this.
Across it, but just remind me and the listeners.
You have a huge amount of bullion comes from South America into Europe in the early 17th century after the beginning of the colonialism. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that money is then shifted to Asia, as people buy goods and produce from India, China. So that's what causes the boom in silk, in spices. Mm. But also then you have Indian royalty who get vast amounts of money, much now as Premier League clubs from this TV deal, had money beyond what they could ever dream of. People who were already rich suddenly being even more rich. And they started buying horses. And so they initially...
Just any race horses or any old horse?
Well, that's a very good point.
Okay, thanks.
Because this is one of the problems. They initially go after Arab stallions, and then when they can't get Arab stallions,
it's a film that Barry likes.
They go after
fullbacks,
a type of horse that looks a bit like an Arab stallion but isn't. The Kathiawar breed.
Okay.
I guess after going instead of going after wingers or skillful players, they go after things that look a bit like wingers. They're fullbacks. And then come the end of the 17th century, the army have realised actually this is no use. They need much sturdy horses rather than these sort of show ponies.
You need a Richard Dunn.
You need a Richard Dunn of horse, yeah, exactly. But also just a sudden recognition that, hang on, why have we paid these vast fortunes for these inferior horses? And the bottom falls out of that market and bankrupts a whole load of Maharajas.
So your point is...
I can't remember. My point is that this feels like there's a bubble happening. That there's some of these fees that just, well, in fact, most of these fees just cannot be right in any intrinsic way. Particularly, I think, with the wider economy being in a state of turmoil at the moment. So, are we in a? Is this a bubble? Is this about a crash? Now, talking to people at the Premier League, they start renegotiating the TV deal midway through this season to start season after next, so to start 2019-20. And they think there'll be probably a small increase in UK rights, which is interesting given Sky's figures dipped last year, given there's a lot of concern about illegal streaming. But they think that the foreign rights is going to be 60-70% increase, to go up from 3 billion to possibly 5 billion. So the total will go from 8 billion to around about 11 billion. And if that happens, you're getting... a 37.5% increase in TV rates. So that would imply the bubble will keep growing for this season, next season, and then three more years before there's any concern at all.
Thanks, Jonathan.
It's a pleasure.
Just touch on Manchester United. It does look like they've bought players who will play, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I think Mourinho wants a left back, and he's been denied funds for left back, and I think that's an interesting dynamic that there's rumours of unrest there, that the Glazers are apparently concerned by Brexit and potential ramifications for the value of the club, and the, you know, the sort of very free spending of the last 2 or 3 years may not continue, is, you know, the whisper.
Greg, any thoughts on United's signings? Well, Lukaku, Matic, Lindelof?
They've strengthened the spine of the team, which, you know, makes sense. My thing that I've got a problem seeing Matic as being a player who will increase the tempo of the play through midfield. I know I read your blog and you were quite positive about Matic as a signing who Mourinho sees as being, you know, integral to how he wants his team to play. But I just think the problem last season was there was a disjointed between defence and attack, and I don't see the players in their midfield makeup how that is going to change that much. I know Pogba will be kind of released to be a bit more marauding than he was last year, when I thought last year he had to do a lot of donkey work at times, which is, you know, not what your £100 million man should be doing. But I can't see them being the kind of free-flowing team that the fans want them to be. However, they may be a successful Mourinho counter-attacking team and play a little bit more direct to Lukaku, and who he plays along in and around Lukaku is important. Mkhitaryan last season, I thought when he was on form, he made United a lot more potent, but it's whether Mourinho does want to play him that often.
Baz, any thoughts on Chelsea?
I could have some thoughts on Everton.
Yeah, by all means.
Because they've been particularly busy, spent an awful lot of money, brought in a lot of good players, and yet they're going to finish sixth, aren't they? Or seventh. Sorry, it's very difficult to see them bridging the gap to the top six. And, you know, the gap between them and eighth last season was like a chasm. It will be interesting to see, you know, I presume everyone around Goodison Park is delighted, but it will be interesting to see if they can make any sort of inroads into the top six. I can't see it happening, personally.
I don't see where... I think the same problem that Rooney had at United is going to be there at Everton as well. Where do you play Rooney? Does he play up front? Does he play deep? Does he play over on the right?
Especially if you're bringing Sigurdsson in.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because he's the kind of he's a more mobile version of what Rooney is or used to be. I also thought Everton's midfield looked like it was good towards the end of last season. It was nicely balanced. You had Tom Davies and Schneiderlin and Idrissa Gueye, and I thought that was a really energetic midfield three, and it brought Klaassen in as well as having Rooney there, who may end up dropping back deep. And I just wondered if there's going to be a little bit too many players in there to kind of try to accommodate, and whether that's going to be a problem. Maybe a little bit light up front now Lukaku's gone.
I've heard a number of pundits saying, oh, wouldn't it be good if Spurs won the league because they haven't been part of the bubble and they haven't bought anybody?
It's Barry? Going to be very interesting to see how they get on. The Wembley factor is a bit of a nuisance because they obviously, there's this hoodoo, and if they do badly, it may be blamed on Wembley rather than the lack of transfer activity. I think it's very refreshing that they haven't brought anyone in, and Mauricio Pochettino is clearly happy with who he has. And
he started saying he wants someone now. I mean, the worry is they'd panic and buy another Sissoko in the last day, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, I have no knowledge of this. This is just sort of putting two and two together. But if PSG need to sell, would Di Maria be available for sort of 30, 35? Would he fancy coming back to England? I don't know. But the, you know, two Argentinians, with, you know, him and Pochettino, I think he's the sort of player who would fit that system. That, you know, not particularly flashy, works hard when he can be bothered. It would seem a sort of logical move to.
Pochettino famously likes those players who occasionally can't be bothered, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, maybe he would think he could motivate him. I mean, yeah, Di Maria, I think, was pretty motivated until whatever happened after that burglary at United, and then last season the bit's been poor.
I think they're obviously still interested in Ross Barkley, although I don't know. What you look at that Tottenham team and you look at Ross Barkley and you think, would he, if they spent 50 million on him, would he get into that team?
You can't see where he'd fit.
No, but the talk is that they are interested in him. It's an odd one. But the other thing is, had they not been at Wembley this season and they were starting at White Hart Lane, there's something to be said for having the consistency going into the season, starting quickly, getting points on the board and getting ahead of the pack, and then maybe suffering later on with a lack of players in your squad. But because they're at Wembley, I just feel it just doesn't suit them. And they tried to get the pitch dimensions changed to be identical to White Hart Lane, and the FA said no. I don't know if that should have been part of the deal when they agreed to play there, that we only agree to play there and give you our money if we can have the pitch exactly the same as it was at White Hart Lane.
Arsenal, the Stan Kroenke Blood Sports channel, My Outdoor TV, is totally bizarre.
Have you subscribed, have you?
I have not subscribed yet. I'm just worried what Arsenal's pre-season tour might be next year when, you know, Theo Walcott might miss a Buffalo, you know, on the fields of the Serengeti. But on the pitch... Lacazette, 53 million. Well, I like to think, Barry, that in November, my mates who support Arsenal will be telling me this could be our year, and in March they'll be depressed when I quote that back to them when it isn't their year again.
Has that ever happened before?
I don't think so.
I'd say it will be near. It'll be sort of September. They're saying this could be our year, and then they'll have resigned themselves to the fact that it won't be. Before Christmas.
But they usually start the season badly, don't they? But you think they'll actually get off to a good start this time?
Yeah, I mean, Lacazette's a good signing. They got that full-back. But I can't see that it's enough. You know, they've still got the same flaky wasters, some of whom may leave. The Alexis Sanchez thing is obviously still up in the air, so is Mesut Ozil. But... I can't see Arsenal doing too much better than they did last season.
I can see the problem being that they start off playing 3-5-2 because that worked, or 3-4-3. It seemed to work at the end of last season. They need another centre-back, I think, if they're going to do that. And when that goes wrong and you need to change it, or you decide to change it, then that's where the problem will kick in, because you're overhauling a system and the other system didn't seem to work previously. So... It's whether he sticks with that, which I think he will at the beginning of the season, and what they do if it goes wrong or somebody finds him out, which is what maybe you could have said would have happened earlier to Chelsea last season had they not made that change partway into the season.
I tried to watch the final of the Audi Cup yesterday, but Shark Week was on, and it's really brilliant. So I didn't. I sort of watched a bit of Liverpool. Where do we see them? Having been through the rest of the top six, seven.
Well, we also glossed over Chelsea, so we.
Oh, we did. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, can't do everything right in the first pod, Dan.
I think Salah looks like a good signing. He looks like he's ready to. He's just like box ready. He's come in and looks fit and ready to go. Liverpool have got loads of players like that now. I think the forward line is exciting. You have Salah, Firmino, and Mane, who is coming back from injury and was so influential for Liverpool last year. If Coutinho, I think holding on to Coutinho is obviously a big deal for Liverpool. I think they can do this season. I think pretty much do what they did with Suarez that season when it seemed, you know, he obviously wanted to go. He kind of said, stay another season and give us that. I think squeeze as much out of Coutinho as they can this season and hope that that is enough to kind of keep him in the Champions League, maybe push for a little bit more. I still think they need to get a midfielder and a centre back. Van Dijk's still got to be on the radar. If they can't get Keita, it doesn't seem like they can. I'd be interested in Blaise Matuidi at PSG, given that they now might need to get shutter players, and he's very energetic midfielder.
It's PSG are only going to have one player. Well, put out just Neymar.
They still win the league.
Yeah, I still think they need that kind of player, because Henderson's heel generally disintegrates into a million bits about three quarters of the way into the season.
You could take him with you to your orthopedic.
Yeah, could you do that? Yeah.
Well, you think it's a Sunderland problem with feet? All the other side is
there's a genetic deficiency. Yeah.
Is that spread to you, Barry? It's not just Sunderland. Okay, it's just people from Sunderland, yeah. Not Sunderland fans. Anything else interesting from the Premier League? Look, next week we'll go into detail on some other clubs. Chelsea, I forgot.
It's a difficult start for them. Depending when Pedro's back, but Hazard's obviously not going to be back for 2 months, I think.
Mm-hmm. And they go to Spurs' second game, which is
so. Yeah, if they've only got Willian, who I think is a little bit more, functional is the wrong word, but he's a more functional type of player than Pedro or Hazard in the two creative positions behind the centre forward, that creates a shortfall. I don't think there's anybody really obvious who can fit. I mean, Morata's played there behind Batshuayi at times in pre-season. So, and there's Diego Costa still hanging around, hasn't been sold yet, has he? So,
I mean, presuming Costa goes, that I think that is a
but big... the problem with that though is that Atletico can't sign until January, right?
Yeah, but he can go like Arthur Turan did to Barcelona and just hang around for
but
kind of be a vibes
who
man.
Who benefits from that? I mean, I guess he benefits.
Bad vibes man, if it's Costa. Yeah, I don't. Well,
it's a strange situation.
Maybe he benefit his pockets benefit from doing that.
Guess it's more of his DJ.
But
gig.
I just see that like he did the job of two players when he played, in that he took so many defenders, like, attention was all on him and gave space for other players to kind of exploit. And the same with Kante in midfield. So essentially they were playing with 13 players when they had Costa and Kante on the team. Take Costa out and they're playing with 12.
And Costa, I think, of the goals he scored last season, I think 9 of them were goals that changed the scoreline. Didn't just make a 1-0 lead into a 2-0 lead, but actually got them from a losing position to a drawing position or a drawing position to a winning position. And that's that sort of game-changing ability. It sort of goes beyond sort of skill, it's a mental or a psychological quality. And Morata, we don't really know if he's got that. He scored some key goals in Champions League, but he's never been the number one striker at any club he's been at.
But he's a hard working player, isn't he?
Morata.
He'll do the work. It's just
that psychological thing. We just don't. Yeah. I'm not saying he hasn't got. I'm saying it's still a question mark.
Up to the challenge.
All right, look, that's enough Premier League for now. We'll do more of that next week.
Yeah, we're limited in what we can do because the Guardian previews are only up as far as Everton at the moment. At least,
so we just don't know.
Yeah.
There's another one at 1 o'clock, but Jonathan's got to get off before.
Just to say, it's a sort of information bulletin. I know some people will know, but Jonathan Walters has gone from Stoke to Burnley. It's the sort of transfer where you switch on Match of the Day and you're just looking and you're just confused because you just didn't notice it happening. And I'm a big fan of him.
I'm a massive fan of Jonathan Walters.
Because he's quite 90s, isn't he? Mm. That's why I like him.
And Glenn Whelan's left Stoke as well. So, like, are Stoke really Stoke anymore without Glenn Whelan and Jonathan Walters?
Do you think the Premier League this year could be... Can you do it on a cold Tuesday night in Huddersfield? Will they get that mantle?
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, we're going to do Football League preview in part 3, but right now let's talk Women's Euros. 7:45 kickoff tonight. It's on Channel 4 if you want to watch it in Utrecht. We can talk to the BBC's Caroline Barker. Hi, Caroline.
Hello, Max. I'm broadcasting to you from on top of a hotel overlooking Enschede, which has taken us forever to try and learn, although if you're here, sometimes they call it Enschede, which is the home of FC20 and also the home this evening of England taking on the Netherlands. So why wouldn't I be happier?
Are you enjoying watching the Lionesses?
Yeah, of course you do. They're favourites for a tournament. England are going to go on and win it. So why wouldn't you enjoy that moment? They played attack. I'm sure you've all been watching back home, or at least listening. They're engaging football. They've played a variety of different styles of football to get to this stage. They've won every match. They've only conceded one goal. So why wouldn't you love it?
It's interesting quite how positively they talk. It seems weird to hear England players and England manager saying, we're here to win it.
The response, I don't know if this has been the same with you guys on social media as well, but watching some of the response to some of the comments from Mark Sampson, from some of the players, when they turn around and say, yes, we believe we're going to win it, there's kind of the half of people saying that it's arrogance and half saying, yes, great, that's exactly what you should do. And there's genuine belief when you talk to them. They're not being arrogant. They've put the hard work in. They've got 23% fitter in a year to get to this tournament. So they believe they've done everything physically that they can. They think they're mentally prepared. So why wouldn't they now believe justifiably that they can go and win it? Plus, the last three teams still left in the tournament are all ranked lower than them in the world. So they deserve that favourites tag.
Barry, you have a question?
Oh, so...
It's a formal question, I see.
Oh.
It's about to propose,
yes,
I think.
And yes, I do.
Who've been standout players for you, Caroline? And I watched Scotland's heroic, typically heroic Scottish exit from the tournament. Were you across that? How disappointed were they? Because they nearly pulled it off and got out of the group and failed at the death. So there's two questions, really.
Are you aware that the England captain, Steph Horton, also Manchester City captain, has sent France home this tournament through her exploits, but she's also sent home her teammate Jane Ross from Manchester City, and also almost sent home Karen Bardsley, who's broken her leg out here after a collision with Steph too. Jane Ross, one of the real key players going into this tournament for Scotland, injured against England, playing against England, she was out, and kind of Scotland's chances were a bit scuppered then after they lost their main striker, but they were scuppered before they even begun. They came into this tournament, the first major tournament, along with a number of other sides. We've seen Austria progress to the semi-finals, their debutants in this tournament, but Scotland coming into it with injuries aplenty, maybe everything against them, and they just really couldn't find the edge when they needed to. They beat Spain, which was a turn-up, right in the last group game, but they needed to beat them by two clear goals, only beat them by the one clear goal. England did them their side of the bargain, their favour, to see them go through. So, yeah, disappointment for Scotland, but I think first major tournament, they've scored in the tournament, they've beaten Spain. I think they're fairly happy.
How big a miss is Bardsley in goal for England?
Well, you hear from Mark Sampson, the England boss, and he says actually Siobhan Chamberlain, who's coming in, is the best goalkeeper that's currently at the tournament. So at the last four, he says that she's still world class. And she played in the last group game. First two matches of the tournament, England played exactly the same team. Last match of the group stages, they made 10 changes, one of which was bringing Siobhan Chamberlain in for Karen Bardsley. So that was prior to the injury then that Karen picked up in the quarter-final stage. So in comes Siobhan, having already played a match at the tournament. So there you go. If you think that was forward planning by the manager, he's got that tactically right. But she's been in this situation before. When we were in Canada a couple of years ago, they were playing on the old 4G surfaces. I don't know if you saw that. And a bit of the rubber crumb went in Karen Bardsley's eye. So she had to come off in the quarter-final. And Siobhan Chamberlain steps up and walks into that match and sees them through. So she's been in those high-pressure situations previously, and again she's played week in week out in the Women's Super League back home. She knows these players in front of her, so I don't think that will change it too much. Actually, I think that the big change for England tonight is Jill Scott, who's suspended, so she picked up her second booking in the last match. And if you've seen Jill Scott play, she plays at the back, she plays up front, she creates things in the middle. There's no player that can do that box to box quite like Jill Scott. So who do England bring in to shift about? They've got someone like Farrah Williams, who again played in that third group match over here before going through to the knockout stages. Does she come in because she's got a little bit of something about her? Do they stick Jordan Nobbs, Keith Nobbs' daughter? I don't know if you've heard him talking about Jordan and how well she's doing. Do they stick her in the middle? She's been playing out on the wing. So there'll be changes, and that's probably the key change that Mark Sampson will have to make tonight. The one enforced change at the back with the keeper, and who he brings in for Jill Scott.
You just mentioned Jordan Nobbs there, who she kind of gave a lot of praise to England's defence and said, although Jodie Taylor's getting all the plaudits because she scored five goals and it seems to be all about her, it's actually been the defence that has been the key thing that England have built their success on. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, if you look against Spain, for example, who England had, I think it's 24% possession in that match against the Spanish, and yet Spain created two opportunities, if that. So you can see there that they've built up a white wall that they've created, and Spain weren't able to penetrate that. Equally against France, a couple of last-ditch blocks right at the end of that match, the season through the quarter-final. And that is an area where he has built from the back, and you've got Steph Horton. But alongside Steph as captain, you've got a player in Millie Bright, who we've seen previously play central midfield. She's dropped back to central defender, and she has come into this tournament with the least experience out of anyone that's out here for England, and has just shone. And she's played every minute bar a few. She's had the most minutes in the tournament of any player that's out here. Not only has she been strong at the back, she's marshalled that well, but she's had a couple of chances. She had a decent goal ruled out for offside with her head up the other end too. So she's been the real strength too. And then you've got two really quick players, and Lucy Bronze, who's, when you said, Barry, about 4 hours ago when you asked me the question about the key players to look out for, Lucy Bronze is a player that made the best 11 of the World Cup and has just improved and improved and improved. You see her performances for Manchester City, and she's just another outlet creatively going forward. Although we've not seen her maybe have the chances that she would have had in previous tournaments, and I think she's sitting back a lot more and absorbing a lot more of the pressure, but another world-class player.
Caroline, we see at major tournaments, you know, the England team cloister themselves away in luxury hotels. They're ferried around in top of the range, you know, coaches with tinted windows. They're not very media friendly or accessible. Is it completely different with the Lionesses, or are they far more approachable and less, more relaxed?
I have seen more of them than I've seen in my family in recent weeks. Utrecht, where they're based. So they've been staying. It's a little bit unusual, but everyone seems to be swerving this question. They've stayed in Utrecht the whole time for the whole tournament. So they haven't come and trained at any of the grounds prior to playing them. They're treating it very much like, I guess you would do club football, staying in a familiar environment that they enjoy. But in that environment, we get to go and see them once or twice a day. We can put in requests for who we want to talk to, sit down and have a word with. So as press, we're getting all the interviews that we could possibly want. And then they're on their bikes. In Utrecht itself, you've got the busiest cycleway anywhere in the Netherlands, more bikes than cars rolling around. You get hit left, right and centre. The players have been out on those. We've seen them in coffee shops, not the special coffee shops, just the normal coffee shops in town. And they've been enjoying it. Their family have been over. And what they've all said is that they're being treated more like adults than they have been previously. I think Mark Sampson, when he walked in initially into his first big tournament, the World Cup, he says that he's grown and he's listened to the players and about what they wanted and what they wanted to change from what happened in Canada. Not that there were negatives in Canada, but he's kind of given them more time to have that free time. They've got a bowling alley in their hotel. They've been out cycling. They've been out talking to people. The fans come and meet them. So I think they're very much enjoying the experience of the Netherlands.
I know you've got to go, Caroline, but in a word, are we any good at penalties?
They've been practicing them. I've been trying to have a little sneaky peek through. They kick you out 15 minutes after training has started. But we can hear them cheering lots. So if that perhaps is an omen, then a cheer is better than going, oh, no, we've
caught
that one.
That might be the goalkeeper saving them.
Or they might just be saying, what we'll do is we'll cheer, even if we miss or score, so then people think that. Thanks for your time, Caroline. Appreciate it. Enjoy the game tonight.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Caroline Barker there, working for the BBC out there. 23% fitter. Jonathan, when you've had your orthopaedics put in, will you be 23% fit? Is that the aim?
I'm now worried about Jill Scott, because she's also from Sunderland. Maybe not playing tonight, maybe having a game off will do a feat the world of good.
Right, that'll do for part two. In part three, the Football League preview and any other business. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Football League kicks off this weekend. John Ashdowns, our Football League expert, has come in, so no one else had to do any extra work. How are you, John?
I'm not bad, thanks, Max.
Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. Do you want to concentrate on the Championship? I'm going to Exeter on Saturday to watch Cambridge have their promotion dream shattered in the first game of the season. But do you want to jump to the Championship? Or do you want to? I can tell you who the favourites for League Two and League One.
Yeah, no, if you want to run through them.
League Two, Mansfield, Luton, Lincoln and Coventry are your best bets, apparently. League One, Blackburn, Wigan, Portsmouth and Bradford. So look, we've covered League One and League Two in great detail.
It's so sad that Coventry are in League Two.
And Blackburn are in League One. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Championship, where do you want to start, Jonathan? Lots of foreigners, aren't there?
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. We could start at the top, couldn't we?
Yeah, okay.
Or who we think might be at the top. Mm. Because it used to be that, back in the day, or at least I can still remember the time when if you described a second division or a championship team of having had a big spending summer, it meant they'd signed a £600,000 left-back from the third division. But Middlesbrough have had a proper big spending summer. They spent something close to £50 million, or one Kyle Walker, on a whole host of players.
Who have they got?
Well, they spent nearly £15 million on Britt Asombalonga from Nottingham Forest. Martin Braithwaite's come in for £9 million. Ashley Fletcher for £6.5 million. Johnny Howson in midfield for £5 million. Darren Randolph in goal for £5 million. And quite crucially, they haven't really lost anybody that they didn't want to lose from last season. So you've got Martin Deroon still there for now anyway. Ben Gibson, Rudy Gusted and Patrick Bamford. So they'll score a lot of goals. And crucially, they've got a very good manager.
That was the problem last season. So is it just a case of stepping down and you score loads of goals?
I think Bamford's record at Championship level is very different to his record at Premier League level.
I so want him to be a success, because he has grade 8 violin. But I just seems like such a nice man, Patrick Bamford, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's the sort of modern-day Robert Earnshaw, isn't he? That he'll score goals in the Championship, but it's just not quite got cut out for the Premier League. And I think Gary Monk is a guy who can probably get the most out of that squad, having left Leeds in a close season, where he did a fantastic job last season in fairly trying circumstances. So yeah, they'll be there or thereabouts, I would have thought.
Aston Villa, have some headlines. They signed a centre-back from Chelsea called John Terry. I don't know if anyone's going to cross this. That's quite big news for them, I presume.
It is, yeah. They've kind of done the... They did most of their spending in sort of January and last season, where they spent a bit on people like Scott Hogan and Henry Lansbury and Kodjia from Bristol City. So this season they've concentrated on, or this close season they've concentrated on getting a few sort of experienced names like Glenn Whelan and Chris Samba and Ahmed Al Mohammadi.
They got Samba as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Quite a sort of. Are they playing three with a very quick person as well?
Somebody
as,
to run somewhere.
Well, it's interesting to see if Samba and Terry, you know, will be good. I mean, will be, because they're not quick, are they?
It feels fairly unlikely that you'd pair those two in the centre of defence. Mm. But yeah, I don't think many other sort of fans of Championship teams were too sort of miffed about the signing of John Terry in terms of, you know, being gutted about missing out. You know, it's an interesting signing, but I don't know if it's a season changing signing. I'm sure he'll do fine, but I kind of think that, you know, teams like Huddersfield and Brighton last season showed the way of getting, or one way certainly of getting up to the Premier League, was to go with younger, hungrier players, and perhaps signing the old lags that are coming down level perhaps is a slightly dated way of doing it, and perhaps Steve Bruce is sort of stuck in that old way. We'll see. It'll be a surprise if they're not in the mix, because they have got a strong squad.
I heard Alex Bruce saying he was a bit disappointed that his dad didn't buy him. Who else is out there? I've got Fulham, Wolves and Sheffield Wednesday. Wolves is just a sort of bizarre situation which doesn't feel right.
That Ruben Neves signing, it seems very Tevez Mascherano ilk, the kind of the car park club.
Yes.
Because he was such a young, you know, just a young promising player at Porto who seemed destined to maybe outgrow Porto. And there he is in Wolverhampton.
Yeah, 15.8 million they spent on him. That's the thing with Wolves, or George Mendes FC, you sort of don't know... What the plan is?
They're changing the badge to just his face.
Just his face, yeah. You know, what is the grand plan? What's the end game? I don't know. Presumably, it's to have a shot at promotion this year. I mean, with the type of player that he's brought in, it's hard to sort of tell exactly how they'll work in the second tier.
Do you think everyone will hate them? I mean, I was chatting to a Wolves fan who just said, you know, it's those sort of things you think ethically this is terrible, but if it happens to your club, you're like, this is just brilliant.
Yeah, well, they'll be happy enough if it works out. Mm. I mean, if they're kind of mid-table come Christmas, then things might not be quite so rosy.
If they're constantly bringing in players on loan, seven or eight at a time, surely that's going to damage them in the long term, because you do need to have some consistency, don't you, as well? So I can't see it being all positive.
Before I let Barry and Jonathan sort of loose on a Sunderland rant, is there anything else you want to add? Because I know you're quite busy today. You've come, you know, out of a special, some other floor of the Guardian I haven't been to yet to do this.
Just, I suppose, in a way, I wonder if it's fair to say that the Championship is a slightly happier place this season, given that, you know, Nottingham Forest are in a new owners, Leeds under new ownership, Millwall's ground situation seems to have sort of been sorted out. So I wonder if, you know, it'd be a division of smiles this year.
Not in Sunderland, it won't.
And that's a great way to move on to Sunderland. Thank you, John. You're happy to hang around, do whatever you like. Sunderland, Jonathan, Barry, who wants to start?
Darren Gibson. I'll just keep my material dry, because I already know what Jonathan thinks. So it's very good, so he should share it with the master. Okay.
Well, I was moderately optimistic until Saturday. I think pre-season it looked all right. You know, Catamol and Dong in the back of midfield is pretty solid. I don't quite know what's happening. Why? Because you got Lentz and Kasri, who, were they committed, could be devastating Championship level. But, you know, the assumption was they're going to be sold. They're still there. I think they both want to be sold. Lentz has been quite vocal about that. I think there's negotiations still going on with Besiktas. Besiktas offered $3 million earlier this week. Sunderland think he's worth $8 million. He played very well at Besiktas last season. You know, in there, you got a quarter final of Europa League, I think, and looked very good. Didn't look like the player we'd seen in Sunderland at all, apart from when he scored that chip against West Ham. But the problem is a whole series of players who seem not to want to be there, and Lamine Kone maybe is the most disappointing of all of them, because when he came in, in January under Sam Allardyce, he looked brilliant. Scored the two goals against Everton and kept Sunderland up. And then Everton offered him a move, didn't work out, and he's basically sulked for a year. Now, if he can get his head back right, and if he can...
That's a long time to sulk, isn't it?
Yeah, if he can sort of reset and think to himself, well, the only way I'm going to get a move to a top-half Premier League club, which I think he's good enough for, is to play well and to actually be committed, then yeah, him alongside John O'Shea or a little bit less so Papi Chilabodji, could be very effective. But if he's sort of in a huff as he was most last season, it's not gonna work. And obviously the on Saturday losing 5-0 at Celtic at home is not great.
Barry, do you think you could be in a huff for a whole year?
Nah. Recent events sent me into a bit of a huff, but I was over it in about an hour. I won't divulge what they were.
No, that's very personal to you, isn't it, Barry? Did you like Darren Gibson's video?
I mean, the irony of a Sunderland player possibly sort of issuing the most emphatic declaration of loyalty I've heard from one in a very long time, while he was 9 sheets to the wind, hasn't been lost on me. You know, I really committed to this.
I love you.
You're my best mate.
I'm also intrigued. Why is he at Ramside Hall, which is the bar he was in, which is a hotel just outside Durham? Like, it's an odd place to... I mean, it's sort of a...
Where would you put him? Like Tiger? Well, I thought that's the...
Ramside is somewhere where you go... Yeah, I mean, I guess a businessman doing work in Durham might stay there, but it's sort of a wedding venue, or you might have a wake there or something. So I don't know. Does he live in a hotel?
I don't know.
Do you see? You might have a wake there.
You might have a wake. I have been to a wake there. I've been to both a wake and a wedding there.
Okay.
Which I think better. I interviewed Niall Quinn there.
Yeah, it's that kind of place.
Was it a wake or not?
No, it was an interview.
Okay. But he was stitched up, wasn't he? I mean,
he was.
Maybe shouldn't have been there, especially after that result.
You know, he probably should know better, but yeah, he was stitched up.
Well, arguably, the look ahead to the Football League has been quite Sunderland-focused. But look, I'm very conscious you've got 2 minutes until fitting time, Jonathan. And Barry's done a fit by a corner, however short it is.
Well, I'll just rattle through it.
Rattle through it.
We saw last night Celtic went through to the final qualifying round against by beating Rosenborg. Hearts have sacked Ian Cathro, the inverted commas laptop manager, who was the subject of a lot of criticism on his appointment from people like Chris Boyd and other proper football men. So he's been sacked after just 7 months, a few days before the start of the season. And, Max, you will be absolutely delighted to hear that Cambridge United manager Sean Derry...
Yeah, I'm not happy about this. Yeah. No, I'm not happy about it. I like Sean Derry.
Have you been in touch with Sean Derry to please stay?
No, not yet. Or? Not yet. I was going to not name drop at all during the first part. I'll ring him now. Sad times for us if we lose him.
Yeah.
I think he's happy with his family down south, I think.
You hope.
I hope, yeah. Right.
Can I very briefly mention a former club of mine? Well, very briefly.
Of course, yeah.
Club. Yeah. Chorley, who played Wigan in a pre-season friendly the other day.
Yeah,
who, if listeners aren't aware of this, Chorley arranged this game, which they thought was against Wigan's under-21s, so they had their under-21 team out, which is the reserve team, which is the team I briefly played for after I got sent packing by Marine. And they turned up to play this game, and Wigan had sent predominantly their first team, including Will Grigg, and Wigan went on and spanked Chorley 14-0 in this pre-season game. Matt Janssen, who you remember, is the manager of Chorley. He said, oh, there's obviously a misunderstanding. We were sending our under-21s. Wigan should have sent theirs as well, so we're not taking that, don't take it serious or anything. But on Wigan's official website, their match report said, Latics were merciless as they emphatically put an inexperienced Chorley side to the sword. Make no mistake, Latics were absolutely ruthless. It was absolutely exhibition stuff before the break, as Latics smashed in 8 goals, playing some brilliant stuff at times, matched by clinical finishing when it mattered. So they obviously, enjoyed it, and no apologies from them whatsoever.
You can only play who turns up, can't you? Had you finished fit by a corner, Barry?
And just a couple of other things. Rangers had the worst day of their entire history. Was it in early July or late June when they the Supreme Court ruled in favour of the Queen, that many Rangers fans love so much, and her revenue and customs over the employee benefit trust thing. And then they proceeded to get knocked out of the Europa League by Progress Niederkamm from Luxembourg, which was a total humiliation. A night that ended with their manager standing in a bush ranting at fans. the Luxembourg side have since been knocked out by the mighty AEL Limassol. And in other FIFA news, St. Johnston have been knocked out of the Europa League by another team I've quite literally never heard of, FK Traka from Lithuania.
I've got two things to finish on. One, excuse me, the most devastating news of the season before it even starts, from the Premier League, new rules. Pitch patterns and designs will no longer be allowed in the Premier League this season. Rules state that the playing surface must contain no markings other than the traditional horizontal and white lines. The amendment brings the Premier League rules into line with UEFA's regulations for its competitions, follows consultation with the Premier League club groundsman. Because Leicester City's pitch was my favourite part of football last year, and now it'll just be boring like all the other ones.
He'll find a loophole. Yeah, that
the Blizzard cover this year is horizontal lines on the pitch. Yep, so they followed our lead.
And I'm going to finish, because apparently I think I'm meant to have some sort of Italian sort of football thing going on. Okay. Has anyone heard about Totti's final shirt? Roma have honoured club legend Francesco Totti by launching the striker's final shirt into space. On Tuesday, a rocket carrying the number 10 shirt from his final game against Genoa was successfully launched from French Guiana.
There's an old hoodie of AC Jimbo's over there in the corner. Maybe we could do the same thing.
I was going to say, below the line, if you'd like to say things in football that should be sent into space, and you can say whatever you like. Thanks, John.
Sorry.
Thanks, Baz.
Cheers.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers.
How were the muffins?
I thought they were lovely.
Beautiful. The taste was great.
We'll be back next week.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.